WVUA News.
Africa, welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March the 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia moves another step closer towards peace implementation after delisting the TPLF as a terrorist organization.
This decision was already in the pipeline, and of course today that's when it was officially voted upon, and TPLF was removed from the list of terrorist organizations. So that is a big step forward.
Opposition peace holders resume negotiations with South Sudan's government in Rome. Eswatini has reservations about U.S. State Department human rights report, but will engage Washington to find common ground. Uganda is on high alert for the Marburg virus. Malawi's president seeks more support for cyclone victims.
This is one of the darkest hours in the history of our nation. And if we are going to emerge from this dark hour and see the joy of a new dawn in the future, we must all roll up our sleeves and get to work.
And Muslims throughout the world begin their celebration of the holy month of Ramadan. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An Ethiopian analyst is welcoming the Ethiopian Parliament's decision to delist the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, as a terrorist organization. Brooke Hailu is a former adjunct professor of political science at North Carolina A&T State University and is now the general manager of Nahu TV, one of the largest private television stations in Ethiopia. He tells me that the decision, though controversial for some, is yet another positive development for the peace process that ended nearly 2 years of civil war between the TPLF and Ethiopia's federal government.
This decision was already in the pipeline for the last 3 months, actually. The press were reporting about it, and of course today that's when it was officially voted upon, and TPLF, the ruling party of Ethiopia for the last 30 years or so, was removed from the list of terrorist organizations. So that is a big step forward. And of course it is very, very controversial.
You say it's also, of course, controversial. What does that mean?
The decision made by the federal government to put it in the list of terrorist organizations was in May 6, 2021. The reason is the following. This organization, TPLF, was ruling Ethiopia as the dominant political force literally from 1989-1990 to 2018, after 3 years continuous upheaval, opposition of the TPLF was removed from power and a new group came to power led by the current Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy Ahmed. After that, the TPLF was really disengaged from the table political process by choice, not by force, I repeat, by choice, where they decided to remove its parliamentary representatives from the region of Tigray to no longer to participate in the table parliamentary system. The TPLF disengaged itself from the whole political process and also began to openly declare that it no longer recognizes the federal government. After that, it was downhill. By November 2020, the war was started. And openly, the TPLF declared using its mass media that it has taken the offensive and its goal was to take over power from Addis Ababa and remove the government of Prime Minister Abiy. So we have this very, very terrible, gruesome war between brothers that consumed almost 1 million people. But now, in Pretoria, a peace agreement finally was signed between the TPLF and the federal government. And among the articles of this agreement, one was to declassify or to remove the TPLF as a terrorist organization.
The last time we talked, you mentioned the formation of a transitional government. So what is the impact of this decision by Parliament on the formation of this transitional government?
The formation of the transitional government was part of the deal in the cessation of hostilities that was signed in Pretoria. One of the articles was the formation of a provisional government in Tigray. By whom? By the TPLF as the former leaders. And they have succeeded to form a state government in Tigray. And they have tried to broaden up the power base. It's not only TPLF, but there are other opposition parties in Tigray that were included. The Tigray Tam Armed Forces, etc. And that was submitted to the desk of the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, the federal government, Dr. Abiy. And we have come to know in the last several days that Dr. Abiy has accepted his provisional cabinet, list of cabinets. That was one condition of the cessation of hostilities signed in Pretoria and then followed up by the two meetings in Nairobi. And the next step was what? As the condition of all these conditions were met, then it was agreed then that the federal government will remove the status of a terrorist group.
Dr. Brooke Hailu is a former adjunct professor of political science at North Carolina A&T State University, and he is now general manager of Nahu Television, one of the largest private TV stations in Ethiopia. He was speaking with us from Addis Ababa. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera is appealing for additional humanitarian assistance for thousands of Malawians displaced by Cyclone Freddy, which has killed more than 500 people in the country. Chakwera made the urgent request to Malawi's parliament on Wednesday when he was presenting an assessment of the cyclone's impact. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera made an urgent appeal for additional humanitarian assistance on Wednesday after assessing the impact of Cyclone Freddy, which also hit Mozambique. He told the lawmakers that although the country is receiving a lot of local and international assistance for the victims, more aid is needed.
So many have responded positively to our appeal, and I have personally committed to acknowledge every support. For the situation is so grave that we simply cannot take any contribution for granted. However, the supplies we are deploying are far from enough for the magnitude of the need.
Malawi's Disaster Management Affairs Department says there now are upward of 500,000 people who have been displaced, living at 534 camps. Chakwera told the lawmakers to bury their political differences and work together to address the devastation caused by the powerful storm.
This is one of the darkest hours in the history of our nation. And if we are going to emerge from this dark hour and see the joy of a new dawn in the future, we must all roll up our sleeves and get to work. If we are going to see the light of a new dawn again, we must take the necessary steps now for safeguarding a brighter tomorrow for Malawians.
Chakwera announced the government will soon introduce legislation aimed at helping safeguard people from natural disasters.
I also ask you for support of the new legislation that my administration, Madam Speaker, will be bringing to this House to regulate the management of disasters better going forward and to regulate the relocation of people from disaster-prone areas and give them more resilience in the face of future disasters.
Ondwani Nankuma, leader of the opposition political parties in the Malawi parliament, welcomed the plan to have legislation for disaster management and emphasized the government must deal with sanitation issues at evacuation camps to avoid the outbreak of various diseases.
Madam Speaker, given the magnitude of the disaster, our water resources have been depleted, boreholes have been washed away, water taps have been washed away. Let me register a call that government should look into this with other partners, because if we allow these people to continue drinking unprotected water from unprotected wells, then there shall be another outbreak of diseases in these camps.
Cyclone Freddy hit Malawi amid its deadliest cholera outbreak of the past two decades, which so far has killed at least 1,600 people. The Malawi Health Ministry warned this week the cyclone has increased the risk of the spread of other communicable diseases such as typhoid, dysentery, and diarrhea. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The South Sudan government and holdout opposition group resumed talks in Rome on Tuesday, months after the government pulled out of the talks, citing a lack of seriousness on the side of the opposition. Barnaba Maria Benjamin, South Sudan's presidential affairs minister, who also heads the government delegation, says the administration is committed to moving the country forward on the road to peace. For VOA News, Deng Kai Deng has more from Boer, South Sudan.
The Rome Initiative is focused on the negotiating a peace deal between the transitional government of national unity and the non-signatories to the 2018 peace deal. Pagana Mom, spokesperson of the non-signatories to the 2018 peace deal, says the Rome talks will focus on the root causes of the conflict and how to achieve an inclusive, sustainable peace in South Sudan. Garang Malual is the spokesperson of the South Sudan United Front, led by the former leader of the South Sudan Army, General Paul Malong. Malual says the opposition umbrella group and leaders of other rebel groups are attending the Rome talks.
The group who are here now in the talks are SAF, led by General Paul Malongawan, and the other group is the Relay Spelem, led by Pagana Mom, and the other one is NAS, led by Thomas Cirillo. All of them are here. The talks is still on. Therefore, what is being discussed will be clearer by tomorrow, not today.
The Minister of Presidential Affairs, Barnaba Marial Benjamin, who also heads the government delegation, released a statement Tuesday saying the South Sudan government is committed to the Rome peace talks.
I presented the opening remarks where I expressed the commitment of the government to see that peace comes to the people of South Sudan through our dialogue with the non-signatories. The commitment of His Excellency the President, the government and the people of South Sudan cannot be overemphasized that we are ready for peace in order to accommodate our brothers and sisters in the opposition.
The agenda for this round talks will be presented by the mediation team from the community of Sant'Egidio in Rome. Marial says the talks will pick up from where negotiation left off when the government suspended its participation in November 2022.
We have signed the Rome Agreement, the Rome Declaration, and the Rome Resolution, and the cessation of hostilities of 2017, of which there was commitment on all sides, and also the Declaration of Principles, which there were 13 points to be discussed, which we had initialed before the talks were actually suspended. Now we are going to proceed from that process.
During his apostolic visit to South Sudan earlier last month, Pope Francis urged the leaders in South Sudan to put aside their differences and bring lasting peace to the country. The South Sudan Opposition Alliance engaged in talks with the government in the past with the aim of being incorporated into the 2018 peace deal. The National Salvation Front, led by General Thomas Cirillo Suwaka, the South Sudan United Front, led by General Paul Malong Awan, and the Real SPLM, led by General Pagana Mum, are among the holdout groups attending the talks in Rome. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 23rd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Eswatini government says it has concerns and observations about the State Department's 2022 country report on human rights practices. The study cites significant human rights issues in Eswatini, including credible reports of unlawful or arbitrary killings, including extrajudicial killings. It also says the government was, quote, inconsistent in its investigation, prosecution, and punishment of officials who allegedly committed human rights abuses. Eswatini government spokesperson Alpheus Zumalo says the criteria used to write this study is not clear. However, he tells me that the Eswatini government intends to engage with Washington to find a common ground.
They have always been producing these reports. Of course, not every content of it, we agree with it, because we either feel it is far away from the reality of what is happening on the ground, or it is getting exaggerated at some point. However, we do also honor and respect the fact that the report is drafted and crafted from the perspective and expectation of the government of the USA. So in as far as the report is concerned, we do have our own observations. We do have concerns because, first and foremost, the criteria that is used to write the report is not very clear. It is not shared between the government of the US and the countries that are involved. Having said that, whatever that is discomforting us in as far as this report is concerned, we do have a room and we do intend to engage with the government of the U.S. in order to find a common ground. on those particular areas where we feel the report might have some gray areas.
The report finds significant human rights issues in your country, and it says that this is based on credible reports, including unlawful, arbitrary killings, extrajudicial killings, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment or punishment by the government, political detainees. Your reaction?
That is exactly what I'm referring to when I'm saying, my brother, the report, it lacks some substance in some areas. I can as well put the question to you, which is not the right way to do because you are not the author of the genesis of the report. Where are the evidence of the so-called facts reflected in the report? You won't find them. You examine the reports, the content of the reports, from the very first page to the end, it is all making exclamations. There is no evidence whatsoever of what the report is tabulating and is making reference to. However, we are saying, in our perspective, the report is not a tragedy itself because we can still engage with the American State Department. What criteria are they using? What is the evidence to make such exclamation and conclusion? Extrajudicial killings. You know, give me one example.
I am giving you one. Let's say the killing of Maseko.
No. There is absolutely no investigation that has established as to who killed Maseko or who assassinated Maseko. You know that very well. You have no evidence, absolutely, to say it is government or anybody else, in as far as we are concerned about who murdered or assassinated Maseko.
We are talking about Maseko's killing. Whether there is an identifiable person who did it, it did happen.
What if I were to say to you, all evidence in terms of the investigating processes where we are right now points to the reality that Maseko was assassinated by his political and human rights associates, which collaborated with his own members of his family? How will you dispute that? You will dispute that on the basis that it is not reflected in the State Department report, isn't it?
Alpheus Zumalo is the Eswatini government spokesperson. He was speaking with me from the capital, Mbabane. Uganda is on high alert following a reported outbreak of the Marburg disease in Tanzania. Screening points have been installed at the border with Tanzania to stop the spread of the illness into Uganda. It is the first Marburg outbreak in Tanzania, although Uganda has had several outbreaks. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The deadly hemorrhagic Marburg fever has claimed the lives of at least 5 people in Tanzania. And Ugandan authorities have tightened surveillance at its borders to screen for the disease. Dr. Edward Muwanga is the health officer of Uganda's Chotela district at the border with Tanzania.
We've increased the number of health workers that are screening the travelers. Previously, we had about 4 of them, but as we talk, we have 12 health workers stationed.
Minister of Health officials are set to visit the border districts to check on their capacity to handle any outbreak and to create awareness. Emmanuel Ainebiona is the spokesman for the ministry.
Already we've started but targeted sensitization, but also we shall have subsequently countrywide messages to alert the population.
Ainebiona says residents at the border have been advised to report any suspected Marburg cases for isolation and proper management.
The alertness, the vigilance must be high, and they should share information on any suspected persons with the Ministry of Health or the district health officials. Hand washing is key, avoiding body contact with the infected persons or suspected persons, avoiding contact with the vomiters. Any rise in body temperature, they need to seek medical attention at the nearest health facility.
The Marburg virus is carried by the African fruit bat and can infect humans, monkeys and pigs. The symptoms of the illness are similar to Ebola, such as severe fever, chills, rash and diarrhea, often accompanied by bleeding and organ failure. There are no vaccines or antivirals yet for the illness, and treatment often involves keeping the patient hydrated and medication to control fever and vomiting. The onset of Marburg in Tanzania comes as another African country, Equatorial Guinea, is also trying to contain the disease, which may have killed at least 11 people since early January. Uganda is just recovering from an Ebola outbreak and has in previous years successfully dealt with a number of Marburg cases. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The government of Liberia, in collaboration with UNICEF, USAID, and other partners, is hosting the third International Community Health Workforce Symposium. The conference is focusing on boosting primary health care for all by building resilient health systems. Delegates of over 40 countries have gathered in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, to recognize the efforts of community health care workers and to resolve the bottlenecks that impede progress. Rita Jilobwe Duo reports from Monrovia.
Making remarks at the official opening of the conference in Monrovia, Liberia's health minister, Wilhelmina Jala, described community health workers as heroes and foot soldiers in the fight to improve health care for all.
These community health workers have extended health care access to nearly 1 million Liberians. They have been on the front line of our surveillance efforts. To see the impact, we can look to a few basic indicators. Our maternal mortality has reduced from 1072 to 742.
She explains how donors can fully unravel for potentials of community health workers and to bridge the gap of hindered access to health care.
Investment in community and primary care are an investment in the future of Liberia. They will drive our country towards sustainable development goals and the AU 2063. We need to invest smartly to ensure that we have a fit for purpose and motivated workforce.
The Global Malaria Coordinator for the United States President's Malaria Initiative, Dr. David Watson, said the U.S. government is pleased with the progress made by healthcare workers in Liberia and the world at large.
We as the U.S. government are absolutely committed to community health workers writ large. We want to make sure that they're paid, remunerated. We want to make sure they're trained adequately. And we want to make sure that they are well-equipped, because without those three things, they're unable to realize their potential and the potential that they can contribute to the health sector. So it's our responsibility collectively, but certainly we in the U.S. government are proud to support those efforts on behalf of community health workers globally.
Margaret Odira is a community health worker from Kenya. She says she is happy to talk about some of the challenges she faces by meeting with workers from other countries and policymakers.
For a long time, country leaders have downplayed the issues that concern upgrading the community health workers. And I believe from now, the issue affecting the community health workers will be presented by the community health workers themselves. And I hope that policymakers and leaders will put pressure to our country leaders to implement our pay professionalization, institutionalization as soon as possible.
Organizers say this third edition of the Community Health Worker Symposium will produce a high-level report that summarizes current issues and achievements. It will also articulate priorities and next steps with measurable targets. For VOA Africa, I am Rita Jirabeduwo in Monrovia.
And that's it for this Thursday, March 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington saying, have a great day, and please be safe of whatever you do.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter, a roundup of issues dominating the U.S. political landscape, from a possible indictment against former President Donald Trump to the contours of the Republican primary, as potential candidates vie for an opportunity to challenge Democratic President Joe Biden in 2024. Veteran political analysts weigh in on these and other domestic stories next on the U.S. Politics edition of Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United States Embassy in South Sudan is condemning a recent attack on a World Food Program convoy in Jonglei State, in which two people were killed. And South Sudanese women bear the brunt of the high cost of living in the country. Tune in for these stories and more at 1630 UTC in Juba and 1700 UTC in Kenya on VOA Africa.